Jaron Lanier is a scientist and musician who has worked in Silicon Valley's high-tech world while at the same time pursuing his eclectic musical vision. He is the author of the bestseller You Are Not a Gadget and of several influential articles. Before we discuss your more recent interest, it would be nice to learn a bit about your background and early experience in the industry.
Well, I don't find it that valuable or interesting to reflect on my early experiences, actually, but I will say that I found it just wonderfully invigorating to be part of the Silicon Valley world and be doing things in a basement in Palo Alto and to get very rich and then very poor again in sequence a bunch of times when I was in my early 20s. It was really great. And I was part of an earlier sort of iteration of what's become the cliche, I suppose, of kids showing up in Palo Alto and deciding to change the world from a garage. It was a wonderful experience. But, I mean, in the whole, it's still sort of, I would say, it informed a minor part of my outlook. It's not what I identify with most, probably. And it's funny, you know, now I live in Berkeley, and there's a certain amount of romanticization in the Bay Area of the meaning of our geography. And there was a little celebration of Berkeley authors at the Berkeley Library a while ago, where somebody introduced me with some quote from a review saying that I was now a Berkeley person who threw a Molotov cocktail at Silicon Valley across the bay. And I certainly don't feel like that at all. I think that's quite a mischaracterization. What else to say? I mean, the interesting thing is that there was a kind of a minority culture, a very rarefied, curious, weird little culture within computer science departments that started in the aftermath of the 1960s counterculture and was very much alive around Stanford and then Palo Alto, that instead of serving and being subsumed by the mainstream culture, overtook the mainstream culture and, in a sense, overwhelmed it. So now you have Palo Alto kids, computer science kids, telling people what a social relationship is through designs like Facebook. So that's quite a turnaround. Not just a revenge of the nerds, but an absolute unmitigated triumph, total obliteration of the society that came before. At least it appears so now. Very interesting. And the tricky thing is to take this sort of very nerdy culture that we have among technical young people and find a way to get perspective on it, to grow out of it, to be responsible overtakers of the rest of human experience. It's quite a challenge, quite an interesting and bizarre drama that we're going through.
So you have a strong concern about the social revolution that the internet and everything else has set into motion. Can you talk a bit about at least two concepts that you have introduced, cybernetic totalism and digital Maoism?
Oh, well, these are some terms of rhetoric that I used over the years to tease people, to tease my friends, I suppose. Cybernetic totalism, I'm trying to remember. I don't think I've used that one in quite a while. It goes back to something from maybe a couple decades back or so. But that's a term for a worldview that is dominated by computationalism and a sense that the universe is made of information and that people are sub-processes within the program of reality and that there's an equivalence, including a moral equivalence between cybernetic phenomenon. So if you can have a crowd that you can imagine as a being, like an awake noosphere or something like that, or an AI program or whatever it might be, that these things are practically morally on the same footing as humans and might indeed inherit the world after singularity. And that this is an idea that's become very, very prominent. There's even a singularity university now in the valley. And I like to make fun of that stuff because I do think it's silly. I think it rests on genuinely naive and shaky philosophical foundations, and that it has this sort of nasty way of being able to form a phony closed loop with itself where somebody starts to believe it, feels that their beliefs are confirmed, but in order to believe that, they have to lessen themselves and lessen their contact with reality. It's like a sort of a ever tightening noose of the mind once you start believing that stuff. And of course, since we live through our gadgets to a degree, the patterns of our lives can, if we want, be formed to reinforce that belief system. And I do think it's a silly one, but it takes a while to sort of go over why. And I think one of the tragedies of it is that some of the champions of, I guess, the Enlightenment, of opposing religious fundamentalism and so forth, have adopted cybernetic totalism as an alternative. Daniel Dennett is an example. And that's a shame, because then you give people choices between this sort of ancient manipulative thing and then this new sort of sterile thing that's also becoming manipulative as Silicon Valley takes over the world. And I'm trying to find this other path, which is could be called a digital humanism or technological humanism. Then the other term you mentioned, digital Maoism, refers to the fashionability for, oh God, now it's going on 12 or 13 years, for collectivism online, where people repress individual identity and expression for a collective output. And we see that in designs like the Wikipedia, but also in business plans like social networking, where people are data mined and are have their lives guided by their place in a calculated social schema. And I wanted to make fun of it because there is this weird way that this sort of libertarian surface of Silicon Valley, which everyone professes, actually kind of turns into a Maoist substrate if you look closely, where everyone's supposed to share and the individual is supposed to be underemphasized as part of that. So instead of first, the way I put it in my book is you have to be somebody before you share yourself. And instead of that, there's this kind of sharing where what sharing means is being a relay in this larger system. And so you have this quality in which people criticize the romance of the individual author, or criticize the sort of ego or neurotic qualities of the Western bourgeois sense of self, you know, which, you know, can be taken too far, admittedly. But this other idea of this collective really can, you know, there's nothing necessarily smart about collectives. They're not necessarily wise. The wisdom of crowds is a particular effect that anybody who studied it will acknowledge requires very particular grooming and care and a certain kind of skepticism in order to be of value. Now, funnily, my book's been translated into a great many languages and into Chinese twice, once for the Taiwanese market and once for the one China. And the one in the mainstream Chinese edition, the translator called me and said, "What are you talking about, digital Maoism?" And so I explained it on the level. And he said, "You know, we will translate this straight." So to the best of my knowledge, it wasn't censored and it was translated straight into Chinese, which is interesting. Hmm. But I do think the Cultural Revolution, I think, is a should serve as a fateful warning, because in that case, what felt very youthful and rebellious and fresh actually was very repressive and stodgy and deadening and you know, was really the opposite of what it seemed to the people who were doing it at the time. And I'm really concerned we're falling prey to a similar illusion with some of our online designs.
Hello?
Yeah, does that all make sense?
Yes, perfect. And so the book we were talking about, by the way, is You Are Not a Gadget. I heard the rumors that you're working on a new book titled Technology and the Future of the Human Soul. Is that correct?
That is not a title in discussion. there is a new book. I'm working on a better title. The working title that the contract has is The Fate of Power and the Future of Dignity. And I think it sounds a little too ponderous, so I'm playing around with other titles. But anyway, yep, I'm working on another book.
Meanwhile, you've been composing music, and quite ambitious kind of music. I mean, symphonies, opera, ballet, triple concerto, and I'm sure I'm missing a lot. Can you tell us a little bit about your passion for music?
I've never actually written an opera. I've tried and continue to, but it's pretty hard to get all the circumstances into alignment to mount something that large. But I have done all the other things you mentioned, and in a sense, I'm freed by having multiple careers from having to play by the rules in any one of them. So just as I sort of speak my mind in Silicon Valley and don't particularly care for our collective mythology and don't care if I piss people off, similarly, in music, I don't feel a need to present myself with the kind of persona that composers often have to in order to get support. So to me, it's really pretty simple. I just adore making music, and I think I'm able to do it in a way that means something to people to hear it, who come to hear it from time to time. And if it's possible for me to arrange the circumstances to make it work out, you know, I just adore doing it. It's just one of the greatest joys in life, and it's that simple for me. I just love music.
Thank you.